Ukraine calling.
Ukraine has been subjugated under Russia 400 years, some would even say longer. If you want to know what this war is about, you look at Bucha. There is a culture of death represented by Russia, its forces, its society. And I'm not afraid to say it. Why are you speaking to me in Russian? Don't you realize that these are the people that are killing our sons and our daughters? I'm shocked at the level of collaboration and traitors that are here.
I think that's key.
Who takes responsibility for that? It doesn't deserve to be part of the family of nations.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ukraine Calling. I'm your host, Brian Bonner. This is our 16th episode since we restarted Ukraine Calling. And I have a personal note to start with. Originally, we got funding support for 15 episodes from Internews Network, a U.S. media support arm. But thanks to your support from our viewers and listeners, we got the good news that we will have more episodes. So I'm very happy about that. And I would ask you all to please subscribe to us on YouTube, listen to us on Hromadske Radio's website, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's very important. And we started our YouTube channel from nothing, and now we have well over 1,000 followers. So please continue to go. Without further ado, I'm going to go into our guest today in the studio, Yuri Polakivsky, born in Toronto, but his parents are from Kharkiv, longtime resident of Ukraine, author of three books now, well, third one going to be published soon. And one of the sharpest commentators we have going on Ukraine. He really understands, fluent in Ukrainian, fluent in English, understands what's going on here. Welcome to the program, Yuri.
Thanks, Brian. Just tickled pink that I'm here.
Let's start with your book, Bucha, which is going to come out. You were kind enough to send me the unedited, unfinished version. I really enjoyed it. 88 pages so far, but I know you're going to build on before you get it published. And it falls into the category of, I guess, historical novel. It takes the real life events of Bucha, the northwestern Kyiv suburb, which was occupied for more than a month by Russian troops. And I think the final death toll was 400 Ukrainians killed before it was liberated. Tell us about why you decided to do this book and memorialize what happened there.
Legal accountability and responsibility. As you said, I've been here for 10 years. One of the things that's missing here in Ukraine, definitely in Russia, is legal accountability for crime. And one of the key aspects of a democracy is the rule of law. And so the reason I wrote the book, or I imagined it, I imagined the fact of what could be if the proper directions or procedures were undertaken, right? And I wanted to see, and I imagined, and then I wrote it in the book, how that process would be, and what it could be. So that's why I wrote the book, because I wanted to focus on one very important aspect, which is if we want a democracy here in Ukraine, which people want, right, we have to establish the rule of law. And that means that they have to keep people who are committing crimes and war crimes, specifically in Bucha's case. You have to bring them to accountability.
We're still waiting for that. Do you think it'll happen?
Yeah, I do.
It'll take us years, though. I mean, I'm talking about Russia accountability.
Yeah, I don't care. I don't care how long it takes. What is important is that we, in Ukraine, and I write this in the book, that we are a lawless land, but listen carefully. We are a lawless land that has very many laws. We have laws, but there's no justice. So how long will we wait for justice? Still, I hearken back and I make a quick allusion to the Holodomor. And that means that, and what I wanted to write there, and the point that I wanted to make, was that the reason that we have Bucha, even though, and the reason that we have the war, is that we still haven't punished or established traditions here where there's going to be the following of the rule of law that means that the behavior is going to be governed by objective standards, right? And so that's what I wanted to write the book.
Unfortunately, and you made it clear in the book that Russia has never been held to account for anything it's done historically. And certainly you also make the point, you don't let Ukraine off the hook, because we are a country that has been searching for our own democracy, rule of law, corruption fight.
Well, you know, because I was writing for you at the Kyiv Post.
Lots of op-eds, great ones.
Thank you. You gave me that opportunity. And as you know, you told me that you reread some of those articles. One of the key things, or one of the key themes of my work has been exactly that. The need or the road towards democracy, which leads through rule of law, truth telling, the pursuit of justice. These are the fundamentals of a democracy. And being here over 10 years, I see where there's a deficiency in this, and people don't know what these things mean. You know, we were talking before, or rather, no, we weren't. I was in the studio years ago, and somebody asked me, well, do people understand what democracy is in Ukraine? And I said at that point, yes, they want democracy, number one. Do they know the full meaning of what democracy is? I would say no. And so I wanted to write that book not only about Bucha, not only about holding Russia accountable on the world stage, but also to prove or to create a sense of hope and a sense of hope within the Ukrainian community here, or Ukrainian right. society, that would overcome their cynicism and say, there is a possibility for the rule of law. This is a big hope for me.
Well, we've certainly learned in the last more than 10 years, but especially in the last 3 years, what it is to fight for your independence, your freedom, and your nation.
Well, you know, that's shocking to many people because, as you know, and friends of ours or people that we know said that, you know, Ukraine would be overrun in a week. Well, hello, it's now over 2 years and we're still fighting for our freedom and trying to define what it is to be free. And this is not just a Johnny-come-lately issue, right? Ukraine has been subjugated under Russia, the Imperial Russia now, 400 years, some would even say longer. So, but the question is, okay. Right? We this is our quest, if you will.
Why did you? Let's talk about that. We have a lot to talk about today because you're very eloquent, and yes, you've written a lot for the Kyiv Post, a lot of other people, Atlantic Council, New Europe, now NE Global, many other places. So, you're a very lyrical writer, and we'll get to that. I wanted to ask you, after reading the book, why you chose to do it in a historical novel fashion, which is weaving the real life events of Bucha, the horrible tragedies, with composite characters. And two of your main protagonists are Hanna and Petro. Mm-hmm. Who are Hanna and Petro, and why did you decide to tell this book, this story, this way?
She is a character who both was a witness and a commentator and a explicator of what is going on there. So Hanna is a
Ukrainian woman.
Yes, who chose to stay in Ukraine during the war. A lot of people left, a lot of women, they have left. She decided to stay. And what was her major preoccupation is to find out what the meaning is of the war and what happened there. And I felt I chose a woman because I didn't want people to think, oh, this is just Yuri talking or pontificating or something. But I and that's why I chose Hannah, because I thought she was a sympathetic figure, an objective figure in the sense of how she dealt with the facts. And so the way the book is written is in the form of imaginary philosophical speculations, mm-hmm. right? As well as documenting, if you will, the crimes that took place there.
But fair to say she's a composite of many Ukrainian women you know or...
Well, yeah.
Or imagined. Okay, she meets up with Petro. Who is Petro and why he...
Petro.
How does he relate to Hannah?
Okay, Petro is, and I imagine, and this will come across in the book, she imagines that there's going to be a criminal proceeding against the war criminals, Russian war criminals, in Bucha, and done under, under the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. Petro happens to be the chief prosecutor, right? So in the book, there is an introduction of a meeting of the two where they discuss things such as justice, and he proceeds to begin to realize something. And I could have developed it more, but he begins to realize what the importance of the process of pursuing justice is in Ukraine.
And I got to say that there are many other characters in the book, but I will defer to one of my new best friends, ChatGPT. Thank God you gave me the book in Word format, so I was able to put it into AI and ask them what they thought of the book, and it came back. It is a profound and heart-wrenching account of the atrocities committed in Bucha, a town in Ukraine, during the Russian invasion of 2022. And it goes on to talk about, how well-written it is. Yeah, your literary style is evocative and deeply emotional, capturing the raw pain and indomitable spirit of the people of Bucha. Now I'm reading ChatGPT because that's the way I felt. I just couldn't articulate it as well as they did. So I think it was good. I did highlight a few lines. Not the best. I mean, maybe not the best, but you do have a way of structuring that's very interesting. One line: the longer a war continues, the more ordinary it becomes. I'm afraid we're into that phase because last night, I don't know about you, but between thunder, lightning, and bombs, and heavy downpour rain, it was a night to behold in Ukraine. And
yes,
you quote Hannah, I'm here to witness the prosecutions of the war criminals, she's saying from courthouse. I want to bear witness. My name is Hannah. And Petro says, I'm Petro. So, and then they start their dialogue together, their relationship together, I guess, in the pursuit of justice.
I stole that line, by the way, from Victor Klemperer, who wrote who was a Jewish professor in Germany during the war, and he wrote a book or two actually that were named "I Shall Bear Witness."
Yeah,
this is an important part, and why I want it. Yes, this is an important part. There, nothing here is taking place in secret. Okay, that means that people have seen this. There are witnesses to this,
and some of it's on camera.
CCTV. I don't know if you remember the original day of the attack and the occupation when it started, the taking of the nine fellows on 144 Yablunska.
Yes, famous address.
And they marched them.
Russian
there is camera evidence on camera, CCTV cameras, right, that actually showed the procession of the nine being led to Yablunska Street, which was the occupational headquarters of the Russian occupiers. And there's actually video evidence of that. Yes.
And you were up there yourself because you wrote a really wonderful description of the scenes.
Yes,
and Bucha's place. I mean, as a affluent new up and coming suburb,
it is. It is an up and coming suburb. of Kyiv. Few points there. You could actually see when you go to Bucha. I've been there 8 or 9 times, right? You could see, and I think I mentioned this in the book, that there are old sections and new sections. The Russians shot up the new sections.
Yeah.
I write, there's a quote there that says, we destroy what we can't have.
Right.
And that's what they did. That was a really clear awareness of the older sections that were left alone, and the newer sections were destroyed. The other thing that is very very effective or very influential on me was the discussion that I had with Father Andriy, who was the priest who
Father Andriy, I remember.
You know, Father Andriy, he's from Lviv. He's a wonderful man.
Now he's real.
Oh yeah, most of the people there are real, and he was a man that was well. Let's put it this way: he got a call from a city councilor, and this was a few weeks into the occupation, and he says, and the city councilor says to him, "What do we do about the bodies?" Because what the Russians did, not only did they summarily execute ordinary citizens, right? They just left the bodies on the street. And after a few weeks, well,
yes,
the dogs were.
Yes, right.
And they said, what in the world, what are we going to do with these guys, these corpses? And Father Andriy says, you know, in the back of the church, and I've been there, you can go there in Bucha, it's clear. They had a mass grave there.
Is it still there?
It is. It's now over. There's vegetation on
right.
it, obviously, but there are pictures. There are
right.
pictures of the corpses. Well,
but I mean, are people still buried there, or were they identified and then taken to individual family?
Well, it's very interesting. If you ask me, what was really the inspiration for me?
Right.
Is that I saw Andriy. I call him Andriy. I have a theology degree, so I call him Andriy, Father Andriy. And I said, there was a picture of him in the Guardian. And he was in his cassock. And he was standing over a body bag, and it was open. And I asked him, I said, what were you attempting to do? He says, well, these were my parishioners.
Yeah.
I wanted to give them a sense of dignity and bury them.
Right.
Okay? Dignity. And he says, I couldn't do it. Because they were still occupying, the Russians were still occupying where the part of the town where the grave, where the cemetery was, couldn't get them. So they said, "Let's gather up the bodies and let's bury them here."
Right. Oh my God.
And
well, you have it memorialized, and I think that's a service. I wanted, before we talk about other things, move, and probably we should move on to other things, but you had two lines here. The first, I think, is kind of partly where we've been as a nation in Ukraine, and the other one is partly where we are individually. You wrote, corruption is the main culprit, a deficiency characterized by depravity of fundamental moral values. With so much money changing hands, so many schemes implemented, and a myriad of interests being served, but never the public interest. That was the larger. And here's Hannah, I think, expressing what a lot of us feel. I feel like I'm on a quest to a place I've never seen, never been, let alone understand. The trials have not even begun, but I'm already tired. Nonetheless, I know I must find the strength to continue. To give up would not only be a personal failure, but it would have failed my people. Good writing, my friend.
Thank you. That's Peter saying that. But
That's Peter saying that. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. Even though I wrote that, as you were reading it, I'm moved almost to tears because I sense that, and I want you to understand, and the people who are listening and those who are going to read, that there is such a thirst here for justice, fairness, but justice, you know? And in that sense, you see that. Where are we going? We don't know. We don't know what justice is. And I say we, I mean, in Ukraine. I consider myself, you know, I'm already Ukrainian.
Well, I would say you are. You're born to Kharkiv parents, even though your citizenship is Canadian. Yes.
There is this hunger for justice in this country. Not so much to the bottom of things. That's a kind of an English kind of idiom, right? But we want to know. We want to know the truth of a situation. We want fairness.
But is it not least for that? But don't you agree that societies that don't confront, that don't bring justice, don't move forward?
Well, of course.
And we've had, you know, of course. Russia is a living embodiment of impunity. But in our domestic scale, we've also not been able to deliver. Our leaders have not been able to deliver justice.
Just look at our culture. You know, our culture is full of songs and poems that yearn for freedom, yearn for freedom of the soul. And this is one of the things that we've got to get across here, right? Even though it may be emotional, that this is an existential question too,
yes.
Right? Because people are saying, what, you know, the classic question Hannah's asking in the book, what is justice? What is justice? What is fairness? And by golly, we're fighting a war with a country that represents a culture of death. You know, what you just said, does a society need justice or should it be preoccupied with justice to define itself? Yes, to define itself as a culture of life. And what you see, right, in Bucha, in this book, has to be very clear. There is a culture of death. We're represented by Russia, its forces, its society, its soldiers, and a culture of life.
Which you made clear, they're not going to stop until they're defeated in that book, I believe.
Yes, I believe that the war is, formally could be called genocide, what was going on there, war crimes and genocide, okay?
Right.
I would go, and I want to use something else, another term. What you're seeing now is the attempted murder of a modern European nation. They want, when I say they, the Russian strategic objective is to destroy and to murder Ukraine. It's to murder. That's a lot. That's a lot more powerful, man.
Yeah, I don't dispute. I'm completely. They've proven it. I want to just mention briefly your other books. 2023 Dispatches Amidst the Sirens and Bombs, which is a collection of your columns.
Mm-hmm.
Good reading. And 2015, a Ukraine, a Lament of a Promise, more poetic. And the one I haven't read yet, but I will get to it. Well into the third year, however you want to count, or 400th year, however you want to count it. Where are things going right and wrong from your view? Because you're an astute connoisseur of news, events, and the rhythms of society.
A few things that come out. Number one is that people thought that Ukraine would be taken over in 1 week. It is now 2.5 years. The resilience of the Ukrainian populace and the rejection of anything of Ruski Mir has been rejected. This is without a doubt.
What about inside? Are we doing everything? Is Ukraine doing everything it can to win this war?
To win it, they want to win. Now, of course, the question is, how do you define win? This is another key question.
I define it getting back every piece of territory from the 1991 borders.
Okay.
And
I think so,
being
too.
Strong enough that they don't have to fight this war anymore.
One of the problems was when you asked a specific question, are Ukrainians doing enough?
Yeah. I mean, we want the West to do everything.
Yeah. And our hand is...
Are we doing everything?
And our hand is out.
Right.
My question is, what in the world were we doing? We declared independence in 90, right? What would we be doing for over 30 years, man? Where are the people whose responsibility was to protect this nation? Where are they? You can't suddenly blame the Americans or the Europeans, whatever. Okay, I mean, now there are details we can discuss. I'm not a real expert on military issues or equipment provision, right? But is not the responsibility of a nation and the political class to protect and to provide security for its citizens? I would say yes. Who would be best to know? Well, Ukrainians here. But we had Ukrainians here who had to understand what the Russian, what the Russians, mm-hmm. who they were, and what they are. Why weren't they prepared for this? Why weren't they ready for this?
Do you have an answer to that question? Because that's a great question.
It is a great question. And I can tell you. Okay. I can tell you why. I think there was a great sympathy towards and the effects of, say, Russification and so on. I think there was a great sympathy towards Russian culture. You know, I'm not afraid to say it. I said, what in the world? I asked people on the streets of Kyiv, why are you speaking to me in Russian? Don't you realize that these are the people that are killing our sons and our daughters? So like, don't you get it?
Colonialism. The victims of colonialism.
Biggest shock, I don't know if you're aware of this, but my biggest shock when I was in Lviv a year and a half ago, there was a fellow from Kherson. And he spoke to me in Russian, something like that. And he told me about what was going on there. And he talked about his brother-in-law, who is a policeman. And he said that some of them opened the gate and welcomed the Russians in.
Right.
I'm shocked at the level of collaboration and traitors that are here.
Well, we still have it, and it is a bit of a mystery to me. What I was hoping you can explain it. But
well, yeah, in a time of war?
Yeah.
What do you do with collaborators? What has historically been done with collaborators and traitors in a time of war? Can you answer that question? And you'll have my answer.
Well, they're shot or imprisoned. But you're right. I mean, it was first we had the initial invasion, 2014, and we were in a bad shape because Yanukovych had just fled and he had already hollowed out the military. It goes to the oligarchy and everything, but while we put up a valiant defense, Ukrainian soldiers did, weren't fully ready for what was to come in 2022.
No? Who do you blame for that? Who takes responsibility for that?
Well, ultimately, the nation has to provide for its own self-defense.
Rather than have their hand out in Washington and so on.
Right.
But even this past week when President Biden, let me be critical of President Biden, there was a TikTok of his discussion with Zelensky, President right. Zelensky. And he said, forgive me, President Zelensky, for the delay of a few weeks for on the decision of arms. On the sending of arms.
The $60 billion package.
That's disingenuous. It wasn't a few weeks. It was 6 months.
No, it was months.
It was 6 months, half a year. And the Ukrainians were fighting already at a demographic position vis-a-vis the Russians. And they were holding their own, right? And now they had gathered land and so on and so on. They lost a lot of that land because, why? Because they didn't have enough artillery to fire back.
Yes, yeah. No, and we got bombed because we didn't have, we lost half of our electricity production because we didn't have the air defenses to fire back. But again, you raise complicated issues that are going to be discussions of history. The West has responsibility. Budapest Memorandum.
That's not even worth discussing.
The surrender of nuclear weapons. I think that's key. That's why Ukraine deserves unlimited support because they did that. Ukrainian side, as you know, we've had corruption, oligarchy. We haven't built the defenses or the rule of law, the justice that we need, or the strong economy that we need.
But people in the West, and they don't fully understand. I have acquaintances and friends who are diplomats and so on, okay? And I don't know, the ones that are here, they understand, but not fully, in the sense that they have not yet convinced their masters in their various capitals over the fact of what is exactly going on here. Gordon Brown, here I am, it's a conservative.
Talking Gordon Brown, the former prime minister of Britain.
And Labor. And he said that one of the things that we have to, the West has to consider is the fact that it must consider the ramifications of Russia committing an act of aggression and act of aggression against another sovereign country. What people have to understand at the beginning, and even though the years and now have gone by, certain facts don't change. Russia broke international law. Russia is committing war crimes in Ukraine.
Great. I mean, great. I agree completely. But I'm telling
you,
Yuri,
they have to be held to account.
A big part of the world doesn't care. And we have to figure out how to make them care.
Well,
there's a big part of the world doesn't care. Part of it is because there's a lot of other tragedies going on. And part of it is because, as you said, we're like seen as a difficult case. All right, Yuri, it's been great talking with you, Yuri Polakivsky. Probably we should wrap it up and talk about the war, how this ends, how we get out of this nightmare. And let me just throw out some observations. You can agree, disagree. By the way, I agree with you, Budapest Memorandum was worthless, but because of Ukraine getting rid of the nuclear weapons, the West owes Ukraine, no matter how imperfect this nation may be. But what I'm seeing, and maybe you don't see this, is that the West has started, maybe not out of a great love for Ukraine, but out of self-interest. Mm-hmm. And they see that if Ukraine is defeated, if Russia is not defeated, that this is going to have horrible consequences for the rest of the 21st century.
That's true.
Yet at the same time, we have to be aware of the foe, which does not believe Ukraine is an independent nation and independent people who deserve to exist independently, separately, or be left in peace. When you see this going forward, how can the West and Ukraine combine to get the best possible outcome of this war? Have you thought about that?
I have. Actually, I thought about it in preparation for coming here today. I think what we should do is go from Cold War to Cold Peace. And that means that...
I mean Hot War to Cold Peace. Cold War
I
to
want
cold
a Cold Peace.
Peace.
Okay. Cold Peace. That means that I want to see an armature developed that is both political, geopolitical as well, that would isolate Russia. It doesn't deserve to be part of the family of nations, right? We have to talk about, like, even spending on the book, the time that I spent on the book, have to talk about international accountability, meaning that we are no longer going to react just to Russia, but that we're going to have a clear agenda. No Olympics, no membership in the international bodies, international bodies, economic bodies,
no trade,
cultural, sports.
Mm-hmm.
And have a cold peace.
So they are pariahs. Should be.
Isolated. And I would rest assured, I would bring this up. I mean, would you cut a deal with Hitler?
No.
Right.
It's impossible. And you equate.
I'm not. I didn't go to Diplo school, but
you equate Putin with Hitler.
Well, I knew that was the question coming. The acts of genocide. Right? The acts of genocide and the war crimes that took place are exactly the same that Germany perpetrated. We won't cut any deals with them. And I think that the end result should be the restoration of international order.
Right.
Right? That's what that's how this thing started. The restoration of order, right? Isolation. Continue to be what you want.
But...
continue. I mean, yes, I would like to see the arrest and the prosecution of Putin, but the fact of the matter is that if you corner a rat whose only desire is to survive, and you can see the way he reacted to Prigozhin, you know, when they were coming, he takes off to St. Pete's, whatever. He wants to be a survivor.
He's a coward.
I didn't use that term, but his preoccupation is survival. Good, you can survive. But live in your own little hole we do not allow you to participate in our.
Oh, he's crossed it, but he's not
in our cultural life.
He's not alone, unfortunately, in the world. He does have allies.
Yes,
but in this, Ukraine can't change its geography. it is always going to live next door to Russia.
Okay.
And so that means that we're going to have to become, do you agree, a big Israel in the sense that brute military force and readiness, we're going to have to reconstruct society. And you've described Ukrainians are generally peace-loving and are not going to attack anybody.
Right.
Can Ukraine make the adjustment to being a big Israel and being ready to defend itself? And that means taking 18-year-olds, and that means making all kinds of innovative weapons and in great supply. And it means stamping out corruption and really unifying the nation and our Western allies to preserve the cold peace. Can it do that?
Can it do it?
Yes.
Yes. Will it do it? I don't know. Does it have to do it? Yes.
So you agree with the premise?
Huh.
How about the West? Do you see signs? I see signs that they're going to wake up, that the peace dividend is spent, and that the West has finally, it looks like, as slow as it is, woken up to the threat of Russia. Not there yet?
Not 100%, but I think the tide, I would say over the last year, they're beginning to realize that that Russia can be and poses an existential threat.
Right.
But not only for their existence, because that's why you hear all this talk about nuclear and stuff like that, about use of nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. And I know clearly that last year, the CIA director said, was in a trip to Moscow, who basically said, you use any type of tactical nukes, we will destroy your army, period.
We have that capability, thank God.
Right.
Yuri Palakiewski, I want to thank you so much for diving into the depths of Bucha, one of the worst chapters in a horrible nightmare for us, and delivering the story that you're going to bring to people. That's our program for today. Yuri, thanks so much for joining us. And we will see you again next week on Ukraine Calling. For now, I'm Brian Bonner, your host, bidding you farewell and thanking you for your support.
Ukraine Calling.